Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 411.
This week on the podcast, 9/11 is over, but you can still buy my book.
And the main correct takeaway from the California recall is that money was wasted and there's nothing else to learn from it.
Plus, everybody's trying to leave the Senate.
And losing statewide office once is one of the ways to get yourself onto a ballot for statewide office if you're in Texas.
Plus, we've got an infrastructure season update, which is just LOL.
And Joe Biden, just like the last time he was in the executive branch, is not afraid to deport you.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
We're finally back.
We are back. We were together for a while, but we were just not together recording podcasts.
That's right. And then the week after that was the most chaotic week I've basically ever experienced.
Yeah, so sure.
That was not a time that I felt it was necessary to update you guys about the news. So look, the 9/11 anniversary happened. Mm-hmm. You should still buy my book. It's not just about 9/11. It's about advocacy.
It's full of non-9/11 related takeaways.
That's right. Also, it has a pretty orange cover. A lot of people seem to like the cover. I don't know if any of them like the inside, but the cover has been really going over well.
Well, I'll tell you what. Where they had it at the Barnes & Noble that I went to was on a book of other 9/11 related content, and it was the only one that was not of the most depressing colors in the rainbow. So
I mean, 9/11 books are not... I was very insistent that I didn't want it to look like a book that would already make you suicidal before you picked it up, which is what most 9/11 books are like.
It is.
Or they have these like wistful covers. There's a lot of kids 9/11 books for some reason with like wistful covers where it's like children looking at airplanes in the sky or like things like that, that you're like, don't also buy that book. Don't do any of it.
But yes, so, be buying it. It's in bookstores. I have proof of multiple bookstores.
That's right.
Having it.
Yeah, Brent's visited it in a few bookstores to keep it company. Yeah.
Always take pictures, and if just you, for proof of life.
Proof of life. And if you buy it in a bookstore, that makes that bookstore think people want to buy the book, and then that makes them think I should order another copy, which is the goal.
Yeah.
So think about that when you are going to buy the book. And also, if you are in the right kind of bookstore, they will tell you that it has a pretty cover. Because a few bookstores I've been into have been like, that is a nice cover. And I've been like, I know. I picked it.
Thank you.
In any case. The other big news that we skipped over prepping you for because we didn't have a podcast was that there was supposed to be a big rally in support of the January 6th insurrectionists that was going to go on Capitol Hill. But then QAnon like pulled out of it. No one showed up. And it was just kind of an embarrassing situation for everyone involved.
Right. It was like everybody was outnumbered by like tenfold by law enforcement.
Which is how it should have been on January 6th.
Right, exactly. Which is right. And I'm sure part of the reason why they were so outnumbered this time around is because the amount of law enforcement that they had this time around was the correct amount for January 6th. But there just weren't the people this time.
Yeah, so they, I guess, wandered around a little bit and then everyone laughed at them and they went home. And that was kind of what happened with them. Also, they made the choice to keep a lot of the January 6th insurrectionists in prison so that they could not attend a rally to attempt a second January 6th, which I think was probably the right choice.
Yeah, and also,
they kept saying, no, you can't keep me here, as if they've never heard of how law enforcement works for everyone else.
I know.
Like, it was like they were completely unfamiliar. Meanwhile, people just had to be released from Rikers because they didn't have any food or toilets.
I know.
That situation was really horrifying. Yeah. Kathy Hochul did just release like 100 and some odd people from Rikers. But like those were people that hadn't even been charged with anything. Meanwhile, these January 6th people are like confused as to how they can be kept in prison for like literally trying to have a coup. But whatever. Yeah.
That's the American freedom you were so desperately trying to protect on January 6th. Is the freedom to stay in jail uncharged for untold amounts of time.
To be one of the most highly incarcerated countries in the world. That's the kind of freedom you were looking for, if you were wondering what you were protecting on January 6th.
Right. America.
There's also a lot of back and forth about these booster shots. These are all just stories we didn't pull anything for because it's too confusing with the booster shot. The booster shot recommendations change every day.
They do.
So, listen, either you're going to get one or not. No one knows when or how.
Right.
No one knows who you'll be. No one knows anything.
I know. Well, I told you the day before I came to New York City, I just had like a regular doctor's appointment checkup. And they were like, do you want your booster shot? And I was like,
wait,
come again? And they were like, yeah, you can get your booster shot. I'm like, technically immunocompromised, but also like, I'm not really. And they're like, yeah, we're doing booster shots. And I was like,
it's like,
but should you be?
And I mean, the definition of immunocompromised right now is very vague anyway, because people with asthma are sometimes immunocompromised in these situations, and sometimes they're not. And sometimes they are actually compromised, but not considered immunocompromised. And other times they're not at all in danger and are considered at high risk. So no one knows anything.
And I would have gotten it, but the next day was the day that I was traveling, and I got so sick on those first vaccines. So I was just like, I don't know if I should be doing that. But like, now I'm kind of like, do I not? It's only been like 5 months.
I feel like, I don't know. Listen, if they're going to offer you one.
That's kind of how I feel too, right?
I'm ready to
like
take as many vaccines.
Same.
As there are.
I know. God, our friend, well, Kat, friend of the podcast, I saw posting that she got her flu shot the other day. And I was like, oh my God, we have to get flu shots. I forgot.
She I've never been more in favor of flu shots.
Because you and I have talked on this podcast, I think, about our general hatred, our flu shot hesitancy. But I feel like now we just have to get them. Like if somebody offers you a shot, then you just take it.
That I have to be consistent because I've been so pro-vaccine all of a sudden. And my flu shot hesitancy was largely derived from my like debilitating fear of needles. But in a world in which you can only face debilitating fears of some kind, you know, it's either like it's either a debilitating fear of needles or a debilitating fear of dying in the gutter from a disease that you didn't want to get because someone coughed on you or whatever it is. I mean, at this point, you're just facing all the dangers. So.
Or you could just make up something insane like Sarah Palin, where she said that she is not getting the vaccine because she's following the science.
Yes. Well, that's true. You can always say something that makes no sense that's contradictory if you really want to get into it. Well, I still know a lot of people who hate the flu shot, even though they've been desperate to get the COVID vaccine.
It's true.
Somehow the flu shot, I think I have a theory that the flu shot, the bad marketing of the flu shot is what led us here in the first place, because it was very popular among everyone, including us, including people who had no problems being vaccinated as children or vaccinated with other things, to just be like, fuck the flu shot. Because the flu shot, first of all, they were just like constantly harassing you to get it. And so it felt like a thing that you just were like, can people still stop harassing me to get the flu shot?
Yeah.
Second of all, you kept getting sick even after you got the flu shot because you can never protect yourself enough from illness, it turns out. And then one time I got the flu shot and I got like a terrible side effects from it. And all people would ever say to me, even though I couldn't breathe, like I was having breathing issues, people kept saying, well, but it wasn't, you know, at least it's only the side effect from the flu shot and not the flu. And I was like, if no one can explain to me why this is not better than the flu, like in any case, my point is that I think the marketing was bad on the flu shot and that people are taking those same misunderstandings about the flu shot, which we all had because no one had ever correctly marketed it to us. And also they were harassing us about it constantly and also trying to stick us with needles at work, which I never approve of because I'm like a child when it comes to needles. Like I need to be in a safe environment to get a shot.
Yeah, sure.
I think that a lot of people were able, I got to have my handheld. I think a lot of people were able to transition their flu shot distrust to the COVID vaccine at a time where it no longer made sense to distrust anything. Plus, I got two flu shots last year because I got one at the end of the last flu season at the beginning of the next flu season.
Oh, my
so
word.
I was flu shotted more than anyone had ever been as
and
the COVID vaccine started to roll out.
To turn into a lizard person.
That's right. I hadn't turned into a lizard person. I didn't even get sick from those flu shots. So
amazing.
Obviously everything worked out.
Great.
My point is that everyone wants the booster shot and no one knows if we'll be able to get them because no one knows what the guidance is going to be.
Right.
And so it's going to be yet another stressful time where we're all going to have to wait for a bunch of guidance that sounds like it's life or death for us, even though it's not.
Yeah.
In any case.
So we had a recall election.
We did it.
Which,
it's over.
It's so funny because like you, I think, threw this article on here that had like some takeaways from it, you know, that we were like going to read through. And I started reading through it and I was like, there were no takeaways from the stupid California recall. And then hilariously, this article from CNN, one of the takeaways is lessons from California should be limited.
Well, I was reading Hunter Walker's newsletter and he did one that was supposed to be takeaways from the recall. And his takeaways were just like, there are no takeaways from this. This was stupid. And I was like, yes, that's it. That's the one.
The takeaways are that Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. And the only person other than Gavin Newsom was Larry Elder, who was actually too crazy for words.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, that's the takeaway.
The takeaway was entirely unrelated to the election at hand. It was just that the recall laws are stupid and that we wasted a huge amount of money.
Well, I feel
the
like
the takeaway
that
is not to have a recall election for no reason.
Well, and that seems to be a growing takeaway from this, which is great. There's a lot of, I think people are talking about how much this cost and how insane it was and, like, why we should be doing this. And so hopefully,
I was pleased because we
get some reform on this.
This is something that we talk about a lot with the props, where the prop system needs to be reformed, not because I don't think that direct democracy is ever a good idea, but because it's a waste of money that's designed to do something anti-democratic. Yeah. And that is exactly what the recall system is. It's a waste of money, and it's designed to be anti-democratic. It is not about the voters of California fulfilling their vision for what things should, you know, how things should be in California. It is about doing an end run around the voters. So, you know, like all things, it's in California, it's an electoral disaster. But also, it's especially annoying because it was like millions upon millions of dollars that are no longer dollars that people have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was $300 million or something crazy.
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
There's a second takeaway that's also an important takeaway that I also stole from Hunter Walker's newsletter, which is that seeing that both Angeline, and if you're not from California, maybe you don't even know who Angeline is. She's a local celebrity in L.A. She's very famous in L.A., but I don't think she's known to anyone outside of L.A. She drives a pink Corvette.
Yeah, she's kind of like an original Kardashian in a sense, in that she and a long time ago, we're talking like I think in the 80s it was, maybe even 70s, I don't remember.
Maybe the 70s,
became famous for being famous, like moved to Los Angeles and then like took out billboards that she put her own photograph on as a person who was a nobody. And then just,
and those
like,
billboards were still up when I moved to California in 2007.
Yeah, yeah.
There were still Angeline billboards up.
Yeah, for sure.
And now you
she
see her all the time.
She like, I think like self-released some terrible music back at the time also.
That's right.
And then she's just become sort of like this local celebrity. Yes, you'll see her driving around in her convertible that says, I think she's got personalized plates that say Angeline. And she's just kind of like this buxom blonde. She's had a lot of plastic
surgery.
Right,
and everything's
surgery.
Pink.
Like,
she's always dressed in all pink. Her Corvette is pink. Everything's pink. So you can see her. That's what you always know. It's not like, I often wonder like how many times in LA I've like driven past Brad Pitt without realizing it or something like that. But like with Angeline, you're never like, I wonder if I've ever driven past Angeline.
Yeah.
Because you always notice.
Right. She runs frequently. Well, she ran in the last recall. I don't know if she's run other times than that.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
Like,
she's always running for.
She's running for something. Yeah.
And she seems to just spend her day driving around town because she's everywhere always.
Yeah. And then also, so she beat Caitlyn Jenner. And
that's
also so did John R. Drake, who is this, like, gay guy in his 20s who is, like, most famous now for selling a bunch of merch on his website that says, what's it say?
Submissive and breedable.
Submissive and breedable.
Yeah.
So you can buy a John R. Drake water bottle that says submissive and breedable. He also
So those are all people that got more votes than Caitlyn Jenner. In LA County.
Yeah.
Which means, I think the main takeaway here is that we won't get a Caitlyn Jenner TV show. Because
I
suspect that Caitlyn Jenner was in part running to get a reality show for herself because that's her career path these days.
Yeah.
And I believe that no one cares about her enough for a reality show to be feasible at this point. So I think we've saved ourselves that trouble as well.
Same. Considering how bad the first one was.
Exactly. Meanwhile, other election updates, we're getting to a point in the season where we're going to have some exciting election updates, which is our favorite thing. So, cause it's like, who cares about legislation when you have elections? Who cares about things getting done when you have elections?
Right.
You know, it's like, it's like talking about, you know, it's like talking about training instead of the actual sports matches. Like nobody, you know, in any case. Beto O'Rourke, it was announced this week, is probably going to run for governor in Texas against Greg Abbott in 2022.
Sure.
He's been calling around. He took a break from his dentisting on Instagram schedule to start calling allies to see, I guess, if he can raise millions of dollars.
I'm sure he's still doing a lot of annoying Instagram living that is just not on our radar.
I have chosen, recommend all Americans choose this. I think the choice, muting or unfollowing Beto O'Rourke is really the only appropriate choice to make on Instagram as a user, you know? have never been more uncomfortable than I was watching him undergo dental surgery, which was something that he shared with us on Instagram soon after he lost his bid for Senate and was just wandering the state doing weird shit on Instagram.
Yep.
And aside from being out there and going to the dentist, I feel like he's mostly just been famous for also sending me fundraising emails in the name of other people.
Well, so, he's a famous,
you know, he's been doing the thing.
He's a famous loser. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves.
And who do the Democrats like to run for Senate or statewide office more than a famous loser?
No,
so he
losers.
Is now going to have hit both of those things because, you know, we love to run someone who's lost a congressional seat for Senate. That's one of our favorite things. That's the MJ Hager model.
Yeah. Somebody
or the
who,
what's her face?
Yep. Somebody who failed miserably at a run for president.
I mean, it's one of the sadder runs out there.
It really was.
And we're talking about a run in a field in which Pete Buttigieg did fairly well. So we're
lots
not talking about just any year.
Lots of money, no votes. He's great at raising money, Beto O'Rourke.
He is great at raising money. I am curious to see if he can surpass his spectacular loss against Ted Cruz in losing to Greg Abbott, who is one of the more incompetent state executives out there. So, I mean, Beto loses to Greg Abbott, it's going to really have been, a tragic and embarrassing loss for all of us.
It's just going to have further prepared him to run for president in 2028.
That's so true. I had forgotten about the opportunity to run for president. Why wait till 2028?
Well, that's true.
2024. Yeah. I mean, get in there.
Yeah.
He's probably going to be running for every office that is an office that he can't win, you know, for the next two decades. Because there is an office that we know he can successfully be in, and that's Congress, where he decided after three terms, which is only 6 years, that he was destined for greater things. I think what we'll discover is he might not have been. But what do I know? In any case, speaking of the Senate, before we move on to the Senate, actually.
Please.
Texas is just, like, failing at life right now.
Oh
so
my God.
I also have questions about anyone who would want to be the governor of Texas right now.
Wow.
They just basically banned abortion fully. And also in a way that legalizes vigilante justice.
Yeah.
Which I guess sounds appealing to them in theory, but I don't think is going to be appealing to them in practice. Because you know what I think is going to happen with SB8? I've been thinking about this a lot.
Yeah.
There's going to be, like, groups of, like, cousins. People who just, like, know each other and are all just, like, men being assholes together in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to start calling in each other on abortion-helping charges in an effort to scam each other out of things the way that scheming cousins are always doing.
Sure.
And this is going to end up being mostly a problem for the exact kind of people who don't like abortion. It's going to be an inter-pro-life movement problem where they're going to use it to screw each other over in ways that are in line with their fairly antisocial belief system and behaviors.
Yeah.
And it's going to turn out to be mayhem for, like, a bunch of, like, small-time criminals, basically.
Yeah.
Who all see themselves as upstanding citizens.
Yeah.
And that's going to be what's happening.
Yeah. I will say that the only thing that I feel like maybe gives him a prayer after we've just talked, about how he doesn't have a prayer, which I still feel like is accurate. It's it's this. And it's
everyone's dying in Texas.
Well, that. And it's the voting rights.
The voting rights thing.
The voting rights issue there. I think the pieces for him to get people mad enough at Greg Abbott without him having to do much else are there. And that's really why people vote.
I feel like, though, this is a classic Democrat trap, though.
Oh, it is.
Where, you know, they will be like, well, the opponent is just so bad.
Right.
So all we have to do is explain to people why he's bad. As if people in Texas don't know what Greg Abbott stands for. They know.
Right.
They voted for him anyway. This is the obvious conclusion of voting for Greg Abbott. So we did it. You know, Texans got what they asked for.
Yeah.
So, like,
it
there's not going
to
be confusion about what Greg Abbott stands for.
Well, they like using that as their plan because then that allows them to stand for nothing.
Right. And Beto is somebody who sometimes finds it challenging to stand for something.
Great at standing for nothing. Yeah.
Yes. He does.
Yeah.
He's like, he's got that Obama Buttigieg quality of being able to deliver an inspiring sounding speech that had no, like, content to it. And I fear that that is what he thinks should be his goal in this race, because he will be like, obviously things are terrible here. Greg Abbott is failing at everything, and that should be obvious. But I think that they often underestimate how positive voters feel about terrible candidates when they were the ones who voted for them.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they don't care. Yeah. In any case.
Yeah.
Speaking of statewide office, there are also, we're starting to sort of see the Senate map coming together a little bit for 2022. Yeah. So we thought we would give you some insights into that before things really get rolling. There are 34 states that are going to have Senate elections. Obviously, a lot of those are cooked. However, huge number of GOP retirements, as usual.
Yep.
And because of that, there are some interesting challenges in a few states that really could flip. And then also, there's always Democratic states that could flip too.
Right.
So I'm not going to
get too excited. But especially considering like what's going on currently with this administration and how people are feeling, and who knows what's going to be going on with COVID.
Well, and
who knows whether the Democrats will have passed one single agenda item in 2 years.
There is also an attempt going on right now among, so the DSCC has been sort of asked to step back because they fail so miserably at all things at all times.
Yeah.
But in an effort to serve that role that they were serving, to pick failing candidates, party goons have sort of tried to come up with a new line that will help them make the case for the candidates. You know, they know voters want progressive candidates, but they also don't want to actually put forward progressive candidates. So right. They're trying to redefine what it is to be a Biden Democrat as if it's something progressive, much like Hillary Clinton decided that progressives who get things done was something that made sense to say. Mm-hmm. So the article that we started pulling these from, which is primarily about Democratic challengers in three states that have open seats or close to open seats, is filled with quotes from Democratic operatives that make no fucking sense, that are just like word jumbles that came together to describe how progressive Biden Democrats are, to justify them trying to support candidates who have like no prayer of being candidates for office in a meaningful sense.
Right. So, like Connor Lamb.
Like Connor Lamb. So we start with Pennsylvania, because why not? Pat Toomey's retiring. We've known that for a while. The two kind of front runners in that race as of now in terms of the chatter are the Lieutenant Governor, John Fetterman, who is more progressive than Connor Lamb, which is easy to be, but also pro-fracking, so it's complicated.
Sure.
Connor Lamb, basically a Republican. The progressive candidate is Malcolm Kenyatta. You probably know him because you probably ended up on his mailing list, because I have at least three times. So and then there's one woman running. Her name is Val Arcouche, and she is the Montgomery County Board of Commissioners chair. And she's the only woman in the field, and she's kind of created a little bit of an interesting dynamic because she raised about $1 million in the first quarter, which, was not much compared to Fetterman's $6 million. But she has the backing of Emily's List, which spends pretty heavily in primaries. She's the only female candidate in the field, and she's the only candidate from the Philadelphia suburbs where a lot of Democratic voting power is concentrated. So that could be an interesting dynamic, but she's not special.
Right. This is one that, like, I think people also, A, see as important because that it's seen by the Democrats as a potential flip here. Like, this is maybe a pickup. But also, this is another, one thing that I find interesting, and we've talked about this before, is that, progressives have won a lot of House primaries, and they've even won some, House races. The squad is bigger than it was 4 years ago. But they have tried and failed in statewide primaries, specifically for Senate, right? So, that's kind of, currently, the great white whale is, can...
Right, and when they do win, it's like, it's like Marquita Bradshaw. It's in a state that Democrats have no prayer of winning.
Right, exactly. So this is interesting because of the Fetterman versus Connor Lamb, and yes, sure, Malcolm Kenyatta may be the most progressive of all of them, but I think there's a lot of passion amongst progressives for John Fetterman because I think he, to some degree, represents the type of progressive that people see winning in places like this, right? Like, if you've seen this guy before, he's kind of like a tall doofus, but he's also kind of like rough and tumble, and you never see him in a suit, and he's kind of like this, fancies himself this everyman guy, but he's also out here running around telling anybody who will listen about Medicare for All and $15 minimum wage, right? Fracking aside. So there's this idea, I think, among a lot of people on the left that it's this is the guy who would win in Pennsylvania here. This is the type of progressive that we have been talking about. Like, this is sort of a Sherrod Brown-esque character, but probably even a little bit more, you know, Pennsylvania-y for whatever that means, but also a little bit more progressive also, And so then you have Connor Lamb, who is the one who's most recently announced, who's only been in the House for a couple cycles, who, as you correctly noted, is essentially a Republican. Like, why are we having this?
Also,
And John
interference.
Right. And yes. And that's the thing that I think sort of like upsets me about this race. Like, sure, have a competitive primary, but also like don't throw your, you know, lot in with Connor Lamb, because first off, he barely won his race to begin with. And granted, that's maybe a little bit more conservative of a district. But like, John Fetterman is currently the lieutenant governor and has been elected statewide on the same ballot where Republicans have been elected statewide. So like, this is a guy we know can win statewide in Pennsylvania and can win at times when Republicans are on the ballot. Like, he is well liked there. And so this is going to be an interesting one, because it's going to get... Yeah. I guarantee you, even if the DSCC claims that they're going to stay out more than they do, beware of this. They're going to give every dime that is at their disposal to Connor Lamb, and they're going to try and hose John Fetterman at the earliest possible moment that they have.
They are so desperate to get Connor Lamb into some sort of position of authority.
John Ossoff.
He's the new John Ossoff, but like worse, because he's less progressive than even John Ossoff, which is not saying much.
That's a spectacular thing.
But he also, I know, but you know, he's been given these, like, you know, he was given a speaking slot at the convention. Sure. He's constantly being He's constantly being positioned as the face of the youth of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
In a way that is incredibly offensive, because no youthful person who is on the left wants anything to do with someone like Connor Lamb, who is essentially like an old line Republican.
Yeah.
But they are so desperate to give him some sort of visibility. And it's the ultimate example of how the sort of party elite are like wildly out of touch with how regular people perceive and deal with candidates.
Right.
Because they think that this looks like they care, that they have a bench and they care about young candidates. And they do this instead of supporting the really exciting young candidates that they have at their disposal. Because I will remind you, there are many younger women currently serving in office who have really exciting movements behind them. Connor Lamb does not have a movement behind him.
Oh,
he does not bring in voters from other places. He maybe appeals to old people, but old people die, is the thing about them. He's like Pete Buttigieg. He's the kind of millennial that old people like, people hate.
Yeah, there's a ton of these people. There's the Pete Buttigieg. Yeah. You know, we mentioned John Ossoff. What's his name? There's second in line to who people often talk about replacing Pelosi. What's his face?
Jeffries.
Hakeem Jeffries, right. You know, there's a ton of people who, like, just because they are under the age of 50, all of the people in our party who are over the age of 100, of which there are many, think that they're, like, some great, impressive person. And it's like, well, no, they're not, actually. They're just half your age, which is different.
They have an aesthetic and a sort of appeal that feels dated in a way that you would be comfortable with if you were 92. Like, something about them feels old-fashioned. Yep. Connor Lamb feels old-fashioned.
Totally.
John Ossoff feels old-fashioned. They do not feel like they represent what's going on with youth these days.
No.
Youth is just out there on TikTok wondering what their gender is and talking about how they have a new autism diagnosis or whatever. Like, that's what the youth is up to. Like, can you imagine... Well, we can't imagine what John Ossoff is like on TikTok, because we unfortunately had to watch that. And it just wasn't a comfortable fit for any of us.
No,
none of us felt comfortable
upsetting.
With his role there.
No.
And it turned out that everyone that he knows is so incredibly boring. Remember how boring everyone else was who was around him? I mean, that was a real shame.
I do.
It's a real shame to be surrounded by that amount of boredom. In any case.
Sure.
So there's some retirees, but there's one seat that they think is a possible Democratic pickup, because it might be a retiree seat, but we don't know yet, because no one actually knows what Ron Johnson's plans are, because he sort of sounds like he's running for office, but he also continues to claim that he's undecided. He's the senator from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And there is You know, there are candidates on the left starting to sort of filter into that race because it seems like a possible open seat, but no one is really sure what to do. So,
well, also, I was listening to this the other day because Ron Johnson is pretty roundly hated there. Like, he's underwater now. They were, I can't remember what I was watching the other day, but they were essentially saying that, like, this is one of the seats that the Democrats probably hope that the current senator actually stays in for re-election. Right. Like, it is better to run against Ron Johnson than to run against whoever they might nominate Ron Johnson. Yeah, because he'd be so easy to do. You know, I think the one takeaway maybe from California that we didn't mention that I think really worked well for Gavin Newsom was his ability to tie Larry Elder to Donald Trump. And I think that, like, for a lot of these people, that's going to be a little bit harder to do. But Ron Johnson is certainly, like, the leading Trump apologist in the Senate. So, like, I think that, like, you almost hope Ron Johnson decides to not retire.
Yeah, and they also have a similar dynamic happening in Wisconsin, where they have this sort of, like, party progressive, Mandela Barnes, who's the lieutenant governor there. And they also have this, like, populist who's running, Tom Nelson, who's a county executive in a county that you've never heard of and I've never heard of, so we won't even, I'm not going to try to say it because it's a crazy word. But so they have a sort of similar dynamic emerging where they have a pretty wide field coming together. The field includes some gradations on what is progressive and not progressive, but some that should be acceptable to the Democratic Party, and then they will probably still try to find a Republican to run as a Democrat so that they can feel comfortable supporting them, because the DSCC is of that.
That's what they do.
Of that methodology. But so that's another race to watch. North Carolina has an open seat as well. Yeah. Missouri has an open seat and actually has a kind of weird thing. Now, Missouri, you know, North Carolina could flip. North Carolina is a seat that, you know, that, or a state that has Democrats in it. Missouri, not as much. However, there's something weird happening in the Missouri Republican primary that is maybe making it look like at least Democrats should pay attention to that race, because their former governor, Eric Greitens, had to resign in disgrace. And he is one of the front runners in the Republican primary there. Another person who's running, Mark McCloskey, the awkward gun pointer himself. So listen, is it a long shot for Democrats? Yes. Sure. But is it also like a very weak Republican field? Also, yes.
Yeah. They should pull a Claire McCaskill and pick whichever one of these guys is the most unelectable and cuckoo crazy,
get in there,
and then like start funding his campaign.
Yes. I think it's hard to pick between Greitens and McCloskey.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how you would make that decision.
I know.
Try them both. Make sure the only person who maybe they should try not to have be the person, even though he's not a legitimate person either, is the Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, who is also running, who is more likely to appeal to the kind of craziness that Missouri offers without seeming quite as lunacy driven as a Mark McCloskey, who has, you know, resting crazy eye. So Mark McCloskey doesn't look like a normal person when he is in front of a camera. But Rob Portman's retiring, so there's an open seat in Ohio. That's always a wild card. Sure. Obviously they can elect progressives there. And then in a place where they definitely won't elect progressives, Richard Shelby's also retiring. So there's a number of Republican retirees. I would contend not enough Democratic retirees. contend maybe everyone should think about retiring in the entire Senate.
Sure.
That's just an idea I had.
Uh-huh.
You've also got this sort of looming specter of Trump-style fraud accusations already starting to emerge. In particular, the Republican candidate in Nevada, who's like the grandson of a former senator and the son of, you know, a senator in New Mexico, like, is a very well-connected politico, but is also, like, a lunatic person.
Yep.
And has served, you know, he was the state attorney general there as well at one point. He's run for governor before, but lost. He's already starting to drum up concerns about voter fraud. So, and Nevada's in chaos right now because their Democratic Party is in a kind of shambles where DSC is controlling half of it, and like Harry Reid is from the grave controlling half of it, even though he's
DSA.
What did I say?
Yeah, DSC.
Oh, I said DSC. Yeah.
It's okay.
Not that. DSA is controlling half of it. Harry Reid's controlling half of it. No one really knows what that Democratic Party is at present. Yeah. But that's looming, an indication that there are going to be some candidates that are already drumming up concerns about voter fraud. So that's something to keep an eye on. And then there is also, with an eye to 2024, a progressive PAC that has started looking for challengers to take on Manchin and Sinema. Yep. It was started by AOC aides, or ex-AOC aides. Love it's it. Called the No Excuses PAC. And so that's something to keep an eye on as well, because that, well, that should be exciting.
Yeah, for sure. Why. Love it. You don't have Iowa on this list, but nobody knows what Chuck Grassley's going to do either. He's 88.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I forgot about Chuck Grassley,
yep.
And I don't know how, because he is the oldest senator, is he not?
I think so.
Or yeah, is he a month younger than Dianne Feinstein?
Something like that, yeah. They're both insanely old.
They're in the same age range.
Yep.
But why stop now, Chuck Grassley?
I know.
You know?
Well, I'm sure why not? Even at 88, he's probably going to hand Abby Finkenauer her ass, which is who's running against him. So,
yeah.
Talk about worthless DSCC candidates.
That's
anyway.
Right.
Moving on.
Exciting news in Boston, though. They had their primary for their mayoral race. And this is a city that has never had anything but, like, Irish and Italian white guys run for mayor ever. And sure. The two candidates that are... It's two women that are running. Both women of color. And one, Michelle Wu, is... You know, there were a couple of progressives running in that race, but one of the progressives won. And she's only 36,
success.
Which is exciting, too, because that's bench building for you. She's running against the second place finisher, who is also from Boston. Her parents are Tunisian and Polish. And she's the moderate in the race. So we're supporting Michelle Wu, but we're excited to see two women running
Amazing.
Against each other for mayor of Boston.
I
wish that we could say that for New York, but we can't. So that's sad news for us.
We cannot.
We also
Dennis Kucinich did not advance in his Cleveland race.
Or Dennis Kucinich.
I know. He did well. I think he got third, actually.
Oh, good.
And I think with the
I
top
wonder
two went.
Yep. What he does with his day.
I know. I would like to know that, too.
He's been MIA for a while, and then
he's
just kind of like...
old.
Yeah, he's getting old.
How old is he? I'm going to look it up. He's old.
Yeah. I mean, he has to be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he can't...
He's just feeding off. He's feeding off the youth of that hot wife of his.
That's right.
74.
And the height. Yeah. He's... Getting
yeah,
up
she's
there.
Also very tall. That's right, yeah.
She's very tall, and he's not, so it's an exciting pairing.
Yeah.
He is the person, I think, in public life who looks the most like an elf.
No, I think that's
of anyone.
Right. I think that's it. I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah. You can't think of anyone who looks more like an elf than Dennis Kucinich.
Not right? offhand, certainly. No.
No. No. In any case, infrastructure season rages on.
Listen, this is exciting because it is... Inching, certainly, to its close. But it's
operative
inching,
word inching.
But it's inching to what very well could be like a spectacular close in either direction. I'm actually very excited about this.
Okay.
Because,
I'm glad.
I mean, surprise, right? But like it is coming up very quickly because it's the 27th, a week from the day that you're listening to this. That is the day that Nancy Pelosi told that when she made that deal with the Mod Squad, that they were going to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure deal. And
right. Oh, yeah. The day.
Were,
the mystery day.
Right. Progressives were big mad at the time because they were like, well, why? Because there's no way that this other bigger bill, part of the party line $3.5 trillion bill, is going to be done. And they were right because that is nowhere near done. They have not agreed,
not close.
Let alone to a dollar amount. I mean, not a dollar amount, let alone to what's going to be in it. You've got Joe Biden, like, making personal phone calls and pleas and having tea with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and all kinds of everything.
Awful.
Who are both claiming that they're not in favor of spending this much money. Joe Manchin, specifically in favor of just pushing it. He doesn't want to vote on it at all, which would work out for him.
That certainly. Would be convenient for him because
he
doesn't want to have to vote no on it either. So he
right, exactly.
It's a convenient kind of push.
Yeah. So on the 27th, something is going to have to happen. Pelosi is either going to have to push that vote, which would basically mean reneging on her deal that she made with the moderates. But just I think as recent as yesterday or the day before, Steny Hoyer, who's their whip or something, I can't remember, but like
said that
they're definitely going to vote on the 27th. So the plan is to vote on the 27th. So at that point, progressives either have to decide whether they want to kill it, which is what they've said they're going to do, or they have to decide whether they're going to do what they always do, which is just be pansies and fall in line with everybody.
Yeah.
So that day is going to be interesting on a lot of levels. But there's some weird things, like, at play here that is, like, causing, like, some interesting bedfellows. Because, like, obviously Biden wants this $3.5 trillion to pass. It's, like, essentially his entire agenda. I think Pelosi wants it to pass because Biden wants it to pass. But also because I think she understands that, like, this is the thing that they can go and sell to people when they all
I was going to say, what are they going to run on if they don't pass this?
Well, I meant to say that, actually, while we were talking about all of these Senate races and we were like, that's one that could flip. Like, I forgot to say, none of them can flip currently.
That's right.
Like, right. Because there's nothing, there's literally not a single solitary reason that you would vote for a Democrat right in this moment, today.
That's right.
So I think she gets that. But you also have all of these senators who are like, not necessarily like progressives, who are very much like in favor of Pelosi and the progressives and who are out telling anybody who will listen because they need Pelosi and the progressives to hold the line on this for them to continue to have leverage over Manchin. Because because the Senate has already passed the bipartisan bill. So if the House passes the bipartisan bill as well, then it basically goes to Biden's desk. And then there's no reason for Joe Manchin to play ball on the larger bill because, like, he's done. The bill that he cares about and the one that he worked on, which is the size that he wanted, will become law. And then this $3.5 trillion bill, which he doesn't even want to pass now, he can just wipe his hands off.
Right.
So, like, you've had people like Chris Coons and various others who are just, like, who are no, you know, friends to AOC, certainly, out here on the streets talking about...
One way to describe Chris Coons.
Right.
No friend to AOC.
No, like, you know, but he's out here sort of, like, hoping and praying that, like, progressives and Pelosi, whenever you're talking about them as a team, is a weird situation to be in.
I mean...
Because when does that happen?
Also, what is that team? What are the dynamics of that team? Because it seems like that's a team where you expect Pelosi to bite them in the ass at the end.
Right.
In some horrific fashion.
Total.
So there's not teamwork going on in that team. But they seem to have common goals here because the one thing the progressives can do in this situation is save the Democrats from themselves.
That's right.
They are actually hoping to help save people from their own stupidity at this moment. This is not a situation in which they are just trying to be difficult because they want things that are progressive. They are literally trying to protect a bunch of moderate senators from losing their jobs.
Right, exactly. And trying to protect, you know, a $3.5 trillion bill, which they wish was probably 10 times more than that.
Right.
It's not as if they're all in love with this either. You know what I mean?
I think there's this tendency always to, like, make any seemingly big-ish ask seem like you're just kowtowing to progressives as if their wildest dream is having a $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. Like, fuck that.
Right. That's already down from, like, the initial number that Sanders wanted at $6 trillion, right? Like,
right,
so,
exactly. Nobody cares about $3.5 trillion. That is the compromise, friends.
That's the compromise. Yeah. But it's going to be interesting if they do actually bring it up. Are they going to kill it?
Right, are they going to kill it?
You know, well, Jayapal recently said that
they're not going to.
Well, and that's my fear. Because, and this is sort of like when I texted you that I had a conspiracy theory earlier this week that I was really excited about. I sat with it for a few days and I was like, this is less a conspiracy theory and more probably just exactly what is happening. And I just finally figured it out. Because my fear is that, look, you know, we're about to do a whole section of stories about Joe Biden, and that Joe Biden is a man who could use a win on something right now, right?
Sure could.
And Nancy Pelosi is always willing to cave on a large bill to do the bare minimum. I mean, she's like the queen of the bare minimum, Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
So my fear is that the plan all along, especially considering when she made that deal for a vote on this on 9/27, there's no way that she actually thought the larger bill was going to be done. So my fear is that Biden and she, at some point in the next week, are going to decide that what's most important is they pass this $1.5 trillion bipartisan deal. And they're going to then, in the next week, you know, go into a room with the Progressive Caucus, and they're going to say, this is now a must-vote bill. this is the save. You have to vote on this to save Joe Biden's presidency and your own jobs in the midterms. And then the left really then does have to decide what they want to do, right? Do they actually, do they really want to kill it then? Or do they want to play ball with her when it seems like right now they have all the power in the world? But like, I think
does she have anymore? Because she's saying this is a must vote bill, she can be like, we'll ruin the rest of your agenda. Well, the Senate's not going to pass the rest of their agenda. So who fucking cares if she ruins the rest of their agenda?
Well, that's why I mean,
she's robbing them of wins anyway. Right.
My conspiracy theory was that she just set all of this up in a way that she would have a very easy way to blame the progressives when they kill this.
Right. Well, that's obviously what her whole plan was.
Right. And that's why I was like, I was very excited earlier in the week when I was like, I think I figured it all out. And then I was like, oh no, well, that's just actually what happened. So it's not that interesting.
I have figured it out. Because that's the only way this can possibly go.
Right. Exactly.
I feel like, though, this is what I feel like
this does feel
the moderate
though.
Democrats... Yes, well, and also the moderate Democrats are not good at doing this, but I'm hoping that at some point the progressives can find their backbone, because the Democrats are almost never willing to sit with 2 weeks of discomfort to have a bigger win in the long run, but this would actually be worth having 2 weeks of discomfort over. It's not a meaningful election year. It's not a meaningful time. You know, there are not big elections happening right now. The elections that are happening don't have anything to do with federal government, so that people can be like, those Democrats have nothing to do with me. I'm just a Democrat out here trying to make sure you can vote or whatever, statewide office stuff. But I feel like this is a moment where they can't always vote on this bill again.
Well,
it's already passed the Senate.
Right.
You know, they have the votes to pass it again if at the end of the day they need to.
You just bring it up
again. But why not block it once so that you can be like, no, we are not fucking around.
Yes,
we actually meant it. You promised us something and you didn't deliver. There are plenty of good arguments for not passing that bill right now with the knowledge that they can always... get the win back. This win is available to them forever. It's only available to Nancy Pelosi once, though.
Yeah.
So, like, don't play ball with her. Play hardball.
I agree. And it seems like they get it. I mean, I have questioned Jayapal's strategies, you know, along the way, certainly, in this Congress. But, like, she just recently publicly said that over half of the 96 members in the CPC would vote no on it. And that's a lot more than have publicly said so. So that was kind of like a bit of a bombshell when she said that, because I think only, you know, like a dozen or so had like claimed openly,
well, also,
you know, in the streets.
Introduce yourself as a caucus where they have to negotiate with you.
Right, exactly.
Like, do what the Tea Party did. Don't just, you know, play ball because it's the polite thing to do. There's no reason for them to have to vote. There's no reason. The 27th was Nancy Pelosi's idea. They were promised a thing for the 27th that she's not going to be able to deliver. So they can just be like, this wasn't our date. You picked this date. We say no on this date. We'll let you know when we're ready to bring this back up for a vote. But it's going to be later after we voted on $3.5 trillion.
Yep, exactly.
Like, there's no reason for them. But that's, I think that my worry with them, because this is a worry I have with all Democrats, is that they will be too chicken shit to accept the short-term loss. And I think oftentimes they're not good at the, like, chess move aspect of this, where Nancy Pelosi is, for the most part. So when Nancy Pelosi is trying to chess move at you, she usually can think two steps ahead of where you are, which is why she's outsmarted them into thinking that you know, to being, like, her plan was always to blame them for this.
Yeah.
And that was going to be great. Now, I feel like they actually all win if she can blame them for this, because their voters are going to be like, yeah, fuck off. And her voters are going to be like those annoying progressives, which is what she wants. And then at the end of the day, they're still going to have to figure out what to do about this $3.5 trillion. And she can be like, these fucking progressives are the worst. And the progressives can be like, we are the fucking best because we held the line. And everyone gets what they wanted. We tried to say everyone gets what they wanted if they vote no on this. No one gets what they wanted if they vote yes. But that is why they will do it, because that's what Democrats do.
That's what Democrats do. I know. I don't want to spend too much time on this because people have been talking about it all week, but I feel like it's sort of related to this story in a way that maybe if it's not clear, I'll explain. But like, we have to, everybody's had a hot take on AOC's dress at the Met.
Oh, Gala. Yes.
So I feel like we would be remiss as a progressive podcast to not have a take on it.
I feel like my main take has been that poor Carolyn Maloney came in this like outlandish ERA dress that was supposed to be the political statement dress of the night. And AOC comes in right after her with her tax the rich dress. No one talked about the ERA dress.
I know.
She got a specially made dress to, with the whole ERA scrolls and the colors and the whatever.
Yeah. I don't want to, I know, it's insane. I don't want to get into the whole sort of, like, a lot of people have been sort of, like, calling her out for, like, various different things. And it's like, oh, the ticket is so expensive, which obviously she didn't pay for, you know, like, she gets to go as an elected, like, for ridiculous things. And also, like, then there's also people who are sort of like, yay, but, like, Tax the Rich has been getting Googled and stuff. And, like, then there were, I, you know, follow too many MMT people who are just sort of like, we have to stop making people think that you have to tax them to be able to spend things. It's like, well, you can't put that on a fucking dress. So, like, I don't even necessarily have an issue with what's on there. I guess the reason that I feel like it's related to this infrastructure bill is because at the crux of at least what's going on in the Senate right now is them trying to figure out what the tax on the wealthy is going to be, right? It's like, or corporations. I think it's like a 20 run right now, and Biden had thrown out 28, and I think they're now tossing around 26.5 or whatever.
Keeping in mind, so, like, it was 32 before the Bush tax cuts, so whatever. Right.
So, like, the crux of the bills that we just both talked about, or that we, both of the bills that we talked about are the pay-fors, right? That's been the sticking point the entire time.
Right.
So, like, what I would say about the dress is that in 1 week's time, she'll have a chance to prove whether she means it or not.
That's right.
So, like, I'm just sort of holding back my judgment on the dress until, you know, maybe she actually has enough of a backbone to say that she really wants to tax the rich.
I feel like the dress did one other thing for us, which is I don't think that people realized electeds go to those events. I've always known that because the New York electeds are often depicted on the Met Gala red carpet. They all go. So I was aware that electeds were going to that event. I think a lot of people didn't. I think any time that you kind of break the fourth wall and realize that, like, Hollywood and elected officials and all of these people exist in this sort of, like, cabal together, it, like, really irks people. And I think that's really what the issue with the dress was about. I think it just wasn't glamorous enough elected officials that were going before, so no one was paying attention to it.
Yeah.
But her going was a sort of statement in many ways, and she, you know, did this statement dress, and it was a big controversy, and I think that was intentional, and I think that that was probably in her, it was like a genius way to troll everyone, and a smart move, I think, for her. So knowing that she would get slammed for it, knowing whatever, I know she knew that she was walking into that trap, so it's, she had thought of that, obviously. Yeah. She wasn't shocked to hear that you were frustrated that she was at the Met Gala, but I am excited for everyone to have realized that this whole time, elected officials have been going to the Met Gala and sitting with Nicki Minaj, or not Nicki Minaj, I guess, sitting with Kim Kardashian and, you know, shooting the shit in fancy dresses. That has always been the case.
Yep.
And I feel like when you wonder why politics is so corrupt and frustrating and difficult to navigate as a regular citizen, it is important to know that these kinds of, you know, these kinds of special VIP opportunities to deal with elected officials, to get your, you know, to explain your pet issue to an elected official, to promise them money in a, under the, you know, it's a PAC way or whatever, you know, it's like a dark money kind of way.
Right.
All of these things are happening right in front of your face. You're just not paying attention because elected officials aren't very glamorous.
It's like a similar realization that I feel like a lot of people had when we sort of like remember when there was the whole Ellen DeGeneres, like, being like best friends with George W. Bush. Right, yeah, exactly.
And those stories always blow up because people hate that realization because it's unpleasant to realize that it's all a giant cabal of powerful people who are determining how your life goes while you're busy just trying to afford your health insurance. But
that's it.
I think it's good. The best place to make that kind of statement so that people have this realization is a place like the Met Gala where walking in and attacks the rich dress. That's the perfect place for you to understand why we should tax the rich.
There was a billionaire and also, there, by the way.
Exactly.
Rihanna.
Right. Exactly.
Now a billionaire was there. So like,
I mean, I feel like that's what the outcry was about.
Yeah.
Was
no, I think you're
people's
right.
People being flustered by the idea that electeds are going to that kind of thing, and they should be.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
You know? So In any case.
Oh, boy.
Were you worried that Joe Biden was not going to deliver on the promise set out in his initial campaign before, you know, before we had to worry that they were going to try to spin Biden Democrats into progressives? Because no. I feel like this week, the very week where they started trying that spin was also a week in which he fulfilled his promise as the moderate scion of
right.
of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple stories here. And like, you know, we talked about this in our sort of, you know, ongoing coverage, if you will, of Afghanistan, which was, you know, I think you and I were both just sort of obviously like, well, we have to leave. And then like one of the points that I think both of us made was that like, look, you know, because people, of course, were like rightfully worried about what's going to happen to women and children after we leave Afghanistan, right. because the Taliban is a disaster for both of them. Right. And I think you and I both made the point that like, well, we have also been a disaster for women and children because like, you know, we've killed tens of thousands of civilians over the last 20 years and we continue to drone strike people. And who do you think that like is dying in those? And and even if they're not necessarily dying, it's their families who are dying, you know, like, and so it did not take long for the Biden administration to prove our point on that, because a drone strike that was supposedly killing some sort of like ISIS-K person or something that was like at the end of August actually killed as many as 10 civilians, including 7 children.
Yeah,
we just admitted on Friday.
Awesome. So, a tragic mistake.
Yeah, it was targeting a supposed suicide bomber who posed a, quote, imminent threat to U.S.-led troops at the airport as they were trying to get the last people out of Afghanistan at the end of August. This was on August 29th. So, yeah.
And also, even, technology, we're always, with all the fancy drone technology we have, we still somehow manage to, like, just kill lots of bystanders literally every single time we drone strike somebody. Yeah. Like, the technology is not as impressive as I think we are being led to believe.
I know. Oh, seriously. Yeah. Also, even while there were reports coming in of civilian casualties in that attack, the top U.S. general described that attack as, quote, righteous, which I don't fucking like.
What kind of word is that to use about a drone strike?
I don't know. It feels very religious-y to me, which is what's off-putting about it.
Like, yes.
Don't be doing that.
No, that's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Also, don't describe any act of war as righteous.
I thank you. Like, unless you're in the unless you're in the Taliban,
right? Then exactly. You can. That right.
But we're not.
You
if you're we're America. Right. So
like, theoretically,
don't do that.
We're not. Yeah. I mean, that like there's something about that framing of an act of war, especially one where you know there are civilian casualties, but any act of war that feels icky anyway.
Yeah.
Because like there's no. There's no act of war that's righteous. They might be, maybe you feel that they are necessary evils. That's really the best you can say about an act of war, is that it might be a necessary evil.
Right.
But certainly, under no circumstances, is an act of violence that is perpetrated by a state that ends up injuring or killing civilians fucking righteous.
Gross. Super gross.
Anyway, that's gross. Oh, also, we're just back to deporting. So don't worry about it. You can still get deported. There will be no rest for people at risk of deportation because Joe Biden is back on the scene. Just like Trump and Obama, he's going to keep on keeping on.
That's right. I texted you this story last night and I was like, surprise. I mean, you know, I mean, literally, all of the headlines should be like, you know, man, historically awful on the issue of immigration, continues being awful on the issue of immigration. I mean, like, that's who Joe Biden is. It's what he has stood for over the years when he was a vice president. Also, by the way, like, lest we forget, he was the worst on immigration of literally every single Democrat running in the Democratic primary.
Correct.
This was the one thing that he got taken to task for. Well, not the one thing. It was a lot of things, but specifically this thing by multiple other candidates who were running. People showed up to heckle him during debates from immigration groups. He was so bad on immigration. So I do want to just make sure that if there are Democrats out there who are going around really wondering what has happened here, that Biden has decided to send back, you know, all of these Haitians who are trying to cross the border in Texas, you know, the scenes there are crazy. If you haven't seen the pictures, yeah. I mean, it's like, there's like, what, I think 14,000 people like living under some bridge.
I think it's 14,000 people that are like camping under a bridge.
Yeah.
But waiting for processing.
But they're all soon to be in aircraft back to Haiti because most of them are Haitians. There's
most of them are Haitians, but many of them came from South America already been trying to get out of Haiti.
Well, as it turns out,
they are refugees.
Been wanting to get out of Haiti for a long time. And like, also, we should remember that you cannot walk here from Haiti.
That's right. You cannot walk anywhere from Haiti.
Well, that's true.
You can walk to the Dominican Republic, and that's it.
Yeah.
There's only one place you can walk to.
But yeah, like, they're going to accelerate the pace and increase the capacity of deportations to Haiti as well as other countries.
Oh, good.
So
thank God we're back on track.
Don't worry your little heads. Yeah, that's right. Apparently, they didn't hear either the president or the vice president specifically saying not to come here.
No, instead, they saw videos on social media about how easy it was to apply for asylum in the U.S. Adorable.
People would be lying to them several times. They were lied to several times.
We were lied to many times and victimized many times by the very people that they were being lied to about.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
man
the news this week.
Sure.
So get there excited. There it is.
An uplifting end to the podcast.
We're drone striking and deporting up a storm as expected. Yeah. And we have no infrastructure deal, and no one knows what will happen.
I know.
So
these were the two stories that I mentioned earlier when I was like, this is why Joe Biden might just want to pass the bipartisan deal and just, like, call it a fucking day.
Yeah.
Because it's not great out there for him right now.
It's not great out there. But this was always a predictable outcome. I like about Joe Biden, I don't know that you thought I was going to start with that at the end of the podcast, but here's one thing I like about Joe Biden is, unlike with Donald Trump, where I felt like I was shocked every single day by what he was up to, I feel like Joe Biden is fulfilling every expectation that I ever had for how his term would go.
Yeah.
I knew that he would come in talking an ambitious talk and would not be able to pass any of it. Mm-hmm. I knew that he would be deporting everyone on Earth. Mm-hmm. I knew that he wouldn't really be able to tear himself away from a war. I was impressed that he stood by his commitment to get the troops out of Afghanistan.
Same.
But I knew that he wouldn't really, like, stay out of Afghanistan. I knew that we'd keep drone striking because he can't,
of course.
You can't tear a man away from his drone strikes. So I feel like at the very least, we've resumed some sort of predictable horribleness,
which is at least
a less stressful kind of horribleness than the kind we had before where day it was like having 1,000 bombs dropped on your head.
Well, right, exactly. I mean, we're very much getting what we paid for. Whereas with Trump, we didn't know what we had paid for.
No, we had bought a wild card
with
Trump.
Yeah.
So at least we have that.
That's true. Yeah.
Optimism.
Great. And now we can end. We're ending on an optimistic note.
Joe Biden
is terrible, but we always knew it, so it's fine.
But we knew he would be. That's what we told you at the beginning. So there's no surprises.
There you go. We did it.
We will be back next week. We will talk to you next week.
Mm-hmm.
We're back on track now that 9/11's over and my book's out and it's just... Everything's coming back together.
That's right. Buy that again.
Buy that. Some Kids Left Behind. Available wherever books are sold.
That's right.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.